Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Being Yourself podcast. Welcome to the Being Yourself podcast. I am your host, Andres Intrang. And firstly, thank you for tuning in to the fifth episode. I hope that you've been enjoying all the other episodes. And today, I have a very special guest, and I'm very excited about the conversations that we're going to be having. And my guest for today is a very special person I've gotten to know over the past year. And we both share the identity of being Latino, but we've had different experiences, and we've experienced our culture differently and our upbringing here in the United States. And I'm looking forward to having these conversations with my guest today. So without further ado.
Hola, Claudia, and welcome to the Being Yourself podcast. ¿Cómo estás?
Bien. Thank you for having me. It's cold and snowy outside, pero it's warm in here in my house, thankfully.
Yep. Same here. This was a pretty intense snowstorm that we just got. So
yes.
Yeah, it's the beauty of living in the Northeast.
That's right.
I actually look forward to the day that I can just be somewhere warm and I have to worry about the snow and the cold anymore. That's my dream.
Right in your car.
Yep, or cleaning my car. So this is literally where we are today. but again, thank you so much for you know, being here and doing an episode with me. I really appreciate it.
Of course, thank you for having me.
Yeah, as we do the podcast, one of the things that I enjoy so much about the podcast is that we get to know about different identities and different people, and want to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself and talk about yourself and your identities, and let's have a conversation about what that is for you, and go with the flow.
All right, sounds good. So my name is Claudia Rebecca Avilas. If you pronounce it as my parents gave it to me, it's Claudia Rebecca Avilés. I go by Claudia, Rebecca, Becky, Titi Becky, a lot of different names depending on who's calling me. And I identify as a Latina woman, Ecuadorian American. I am the daughter of parents who immigrated to the United States from Guayaquil, Ecuador. My mom in the 60s, my dad in the 70s. I'm a sister. I have seven siblings in terms of like half siblings. My dad has a daughter. Then my mom had other partners, but altogether there's seven of us. I have 12 nieces and nephews. So big in that regard. I love to travel. I'm an educator. I love food. I'm a New Yorker. I was born and raised in the Bronx. That's definitely, spent about 18 years in the Bronx, and then I went to college. I grew up in a working class family. My mom was the sole sort of breadwinner of our family. My dad, he became disabled when I was around 10 years old. So first gen to college student. And yeah, that's a little bit about me.
I love all the, intersecting, identities that you have. One of the things that I find really cool and interesting is when you were introducing your names, and you said, depending on who's calling you, I think that's so funny and interesting because, you know, I have a book that I've been reading and I want to include in the Puerto Rico class that I'm going to be teaching next semester. And the book is called Cuando Era Puerto Riqueña, When I Was Puerto Rican. And she talks about, in the book, she's having a conversation with her mother because they call her Negri, which is short for negra or black, right? And it's a, mm-hmm. it's a way of kind of endearment, a sense of endearment from the family. And she, as a young girl, is asking her mom, okay, what is your name? And then the mama says, well, my real name is this, but they call me this. And then she's like, wait, what is dad's name? And she says, well, your real dad name is this, but we call him this. And I think it's so funny because we have that. You know, my nickname is, and my family always calls me Andy. You know, when I was young, my grandparents would call me Andresito, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's so very, very unique to a lot of our culture of being Latinos, that we have mm-hmm. these different names of endearment, like gordo, flaca, or, mm-hmm. you know, which are so common, especially in the Puerto Rican culture. We do that. I think that's so fascinating. And it's almost like it becomes very specific to who also calls you that and who is allowed to call you that. And also it almost forms a different identity about you.
I agree. So I also, you know, in terms of like my family dynamics, grew up in a multicultural family where, in terms of my siblings or like thinking about my nuclear immediate family, it's Ecuadorian, Puerto Rican in terms of my older brothers and sisters. And my sister from my dad's side is Ecuadorian and Dominican. So, you know, when you come to New York City, there's just so many different cultures, so many different people. And I think, especially when my parents came, that definitely was the case. But yes, a lot of different names. I have my sister who will call me Flaky or Flaca, my sister Jari. So yeah, we do take on a lot of different names. And I think it depends. In the workplace, I'm Claudia or Claudia, if you can say Claudia. Growing up in school, I remember, so my name Claudia came from Claudio, my father. Remember thinking, like, I thought it was a boy's name. I was like, why they gave me this name, Claudia? It sounds like Claudio, and I didn't understand, like, the it was a female name, but I thought, you know, my parents were lazy and just.
No, it's you know, it's, I like the name. I always make it a point that people pronounce my name properly. And I always mm-hmm. make it a point that, you know, especially, you know, if you don't know how to pronounce the name, always ask. But, you know, for me, you're Claudia, and that's how I got to know you from work. And, you know, I always tell people, no, my name is Andres Cintrón, pronounce it Andres. But, you know, I understand that everyone can do it, but I think it's important that people actually pronounce, you know, your name properly as it was given, right? So awesome. You know, one of the things that, as you were, you know, introducing yourself, you know, we're both Latinos. But I think we have two different experiences. Even though we might share, that in common, that overarching, identity of being Latino. But you know, I kind of wanted you to, you know, elaborate more on that experience for you, especially you being the child of immigrants. You know, I'm from Puerto Rico, as you know, and I hope most people out there know that Puerto Rico is part of the United States and we're all American citizens, Puerto Ricans, I mean. So I don't share that experience with you and being raised by immigrant parents, you know, so just kind of was interesting in terms of your experience as a Latina and also, you know, being a child of immigrants, you know, with parents who are immigrants.
Yeah. So I will say, like, for most of my childhood growing up, you know, I felt like in my neighborhood in the Bronx, it was mostly Black and Latino. But when it came to being Ecuadorian, I was sort of a minority in that sense, because in terms of the Latinos that I did see, it was mostly Puerto Rican, Dominican, Mexican. So kind of feeling like, yes, I share this identity as a Latina with a lot of people in my neighborhood or in school and even in my family, right? But feeling like a minority as a Ecuadorian. And so I think that, that was a different experience for me growing up. Having my parents, you know, in terms of like foods that we maybe ate or music that we listened to, it was different. And I think that from a young age, I didn't really necessarily embrace that part of myself. And I think sometimes I felt like I was almost, you know, maybe not always, friends not being like trying to be mean, but almost just having this unawareness. If like I would have friends over and, you know, my mom was cooking something and it'd be like, you know, like a face, like, what is that? Or, you know, like, oh, it's okay, I don't want any. And those kinds of remarks or it made me kind of feel like, oh, kind of ashamed of that part of me. Mm. And so it's interesting, right? Like growing up in the Bronx, you definitely, in terms of the culture, it is very much created by the people who live there, right? So in terms of Puerto Ricans definitely have been in the Bronx for a long time. Black people, Dominicans. So I feel like when you're in school, you almost learn so much about what the majority culture is. And yes, that was very much Latino, but in terms of the ethnicities, it was sort of limited.
Do you feel like you were, assimilating to that culture, right? So, right, because I think when we all come from a different place, a different country or wherever, mm-hmm. we assimilate to the dominant culture. What I'm finding interesting is that normally, right, when we come to the United States, I always think that people who come here from other cultures, other countries, they assimilate to the American culture. But what I find mm-hmm. fascinating is that you were living in a place that, well, yes, is in the United States, but it in itself was an accumulation of all these different cultures. So do you feel like you were assimilating to that culture, to either the Puerto Rican culture or to the Dominican culture, and kind of abandoning and accepting that Latino culture, but kind of almost abandoning your own, you know, Ecuadorian culture?
Yeah. So I think of like the example that I give you with the food, or even maybe sometimes the way when I spoke Spanish, right? It was like, oh, you sound Mexican when you speak. And okay, first of all, I'm not Mexican. And second of all, what's wrong with that? You know, so the tone of your voice, the way that you're kind of pointing that out about me, it you're almost, the way that you're saying it is almost like there's something wrong with that. And then it's totally like not even where I'm from or my family's from, right? And so I remember, like thinking, oh, okay, so the way that I talk is different than maybe my classmates, the majority of my classmates, even my older siblings, right? Maybe the way that they spoke was different, the way that they spoke with my mom in Spanish. So, and I would say like, you know, it was present in my, because a lot of my family, especially when I think of my mom's side of the family, since they came to the United States, pretty much, right, my grandparents brought their six kids in the early 60s to New York City. You know, with Spanish that I heard in my family, in my household, like a mixture of like Ecuadorian, Puerto Rican kind of dialect. But I knew like when I would speak with my dad or my grandma, like I was talk Spanish like a little bit slower, wouldn't use certain words. But it's even also so funny to see how even their Spanish changed. So, for example, in New York City or in the Bronx specifically, you know, we call the bus La Guagua. And that's a word that Puerto Ricans use to call the bus, right? It's La Guagua. And my grandma, who, you know, she grew up in Ecuador and was there for a good amount of her life, like from my dad's side, she would even call the bus after a while. She was calling it La Guagua. So even to see how, you know, some of my grandparents or my parents, right, their sort of practices or the way that they spoke Spanish even changed to kind of fit in with the dominant culture that was in the Bronx.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, we use La Guagua. We use so many different words. But see, this is like really, really fascinating for me because you know, I grew up in Hartford, Connecticut, for the most part. And Hartford, Connecticut is also, there's a lot of Puerto Ricans. And there's other Latinos from different parts of Latin America and so on. But they're just not as dominant. And I don't feel like I had assimilated, you know, I think we all assimilate to the dominant culture some way, but I feel like I assimilated more to, you know, the American culture, right? You know, speaking English and where I think it's so fascinating that you were almost assimilating to the dominant culture in your area, but the dominant culture in your area happened to be more of a different Latino culture. And I think that's really fascinating.
I would say, you know, I think in terms of thinking about assimilating to American culture, I think it was maybe always present there, but I think I felt it more so really like as I was thinking about going to college, maybe sometimes in college, and then as a professional, like, you know, when I think about what does it mean, when I think about internships or things like that, what does it mean to be professional? You know, it's to me, this is something that I've learned, but there's so many ways where respectability politics are kind of woven into professionalism, right? And who gets to decide what's professional, what's not professional? So I think about, you know, maybe the way I talk was different in college. I remember specifically going home like over the break when I was a college student and my nieces and nephews telling me, you sound so, you know, they can pick up on things because they're so young. They're like, you sound different. And I was like, really? No, I don't. And I couldn't tell, but the way I was talking was changing. When I would go to college, you know, people would laugh at the way I would say coffee or another word. And sometimes it would make me feel like they weren't actually listening to what I was saying, more so laughing at the way I was saying it. And so I felt like invalidated almost and felt like I needed to change the way I spoke or like focus on learning better English because I wanted people to listen to me.
Yeah, that reminds me of, you know, the whole concept of code switching.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the whole idea that we're, you know, when we speak, you know, we speak a certain way in certain, you know, specific times or situations, especially because we know more than one language. We have, you know, we grew up in you know, in different types of, you know, households and not Americanized. I mean, well, we're not born, well, we weren't. I'm here, our parents are different. We grew up in a different culture. And, you know, we have to find a way to switch that, right? And speak a more proper way, or so that you can get the interview or you can get the job, or you can, you know, seem more professional or seem more, what's that called? More respected, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And it just made me realize too, like, what are some of the ways that I've changed the way I think right now? It's like kind of thinking back to what are the parts of me that I really liked and I don't want to change about myself, but because I've been sort of, you know, thinking I need to adhere to what's professional, what's not, or, you know, wanting to feel like credible, validated, you know, what are those ways that I maybe have changed little parts of myself because I want to feel, you know, you want to feel accepted. You want to be able to survive in this society.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think it's even more present or even more, you know, it takes a toll on us and it impacts us personally when we are a minority. I think as a minority, we feel that weight on our shoulders, almost kind of like we need to find a way to survive. We need to, you know, break down these barriers and these walls that are already set up in society, especially in American culture, you know, towards us. And mm-hmm. whether it's you know, opportunities, whether it's, you know, not being able to speak English properly without an accent, right? Or the color of our skin, right? And we're all different. You know, we all have mm-hmm. have family members who are much darker than I am, and I look more on the white side, and I can pass for white, and I know that I have that privilege. Mm-hmm. Other, you know, Latinos and Puerto Ricans and all of us, you know, we all look different. We don't look the same.
No, exactly. Yeah, definitely. And I think that when you think about who looks Latino or who looks Latina, right? We've been, I think, sort of fed by media this one sort of image that is white passing, right? And I do have fair skin. I can be white passing as well. But, you know, I think that also has made me sort of think about my beauty and like, or like how I view myself. And, you know, I had huge like self-esteem issues when it came to my nose. Like people would tell me like, oh, you have like an Ecuadorian nose. And I remember feeling like, oh my gosh, my nose, like my feeling like very self-conscious about it and not liking that about myself. And I think that right when you have these images of like what is Latina or what is beautiful, you know, you compare yourself, and when you don't feel like that's you, it, you know, what does that do for your self-esteem? What does that do for your self-confidence? And I think that a lot of those images, right, they sort of erase the African indigenous roots that Latino people do have, right? It's a mixture depending on where you're from. It can be all three, it can be two, it can be it's just a right. It's a mix. And so I think that there needs to be an expansion of what that looks like. Right. What does it look like to be Latino? I mean, there's no one image like you were saying.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that what is shown out there, whether it's in social media and in music or in movies or so on, and all the major, more popular Latino artists or Latino celebrities or whoever, they're all depicted the same way. They're all, you know, when you think about, and not that I want to mention names, but, you know, Jennifer Lopez or, you know, all these other artists that, mm-hmm. you know, Shakira's white. I mean, and so it's like this idea that that's what a Latino looks like, and it's not. You know, you open but you turn on the telenovelas, Univision or Telemundo, and you see all these, you know, they're in Mexico because the novelas are from Mexico and they're all Mexican actors. And that's not what all Mexicans look like. Everyone thinks us, you know. And I think it's interesting that that's what is portrayed, and it's not all of it. You know, we in Puerto Rico, we have very big indigenous and also very big African roots. And we have, you know, we celebrate a lot of those roots. We celebrate, you know, Bomba y Plena. Bomba is a music that was influenced by the African culture and that is still alive in Puerto Rico. And, you know, it's there. And you have Cuban Africans, you know, right? You have, and also in Colombia, in so many different areas. And we need to, you know, not that we need to celebrate that more, but we need to see that more. We need more people to show that and more representation, I guess. That's my word that I'm trying to say.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I think about, you know, in terms of thinking of growing up in my own family, like even conversations with, you know, my grandmother, people she was so quick to tell us about our European, you know, like potentially, oh, él fue un extranjero y, you know, your grandfather or great-grandfather, you know, was this, not grandfather, but great-grandfather or great-great-grandfather. I don't even remember. But, you know, it's like this emphasis on what was that, who were the colonizers, right? Who, you know, preserving that sort of history or lineage. And it's like, okay, well, how about like the indigenous people that, like, where were they from? And there's like less information about that, right? At least in my family, I felt like there was always kind of like this emphasis on knowing the European side.
And I think in a lot of Latin Americans, and you know what I've experienced and what I've learned and read, you know, and I've been to Spain a couple times, and there is definitely a sense of, you know, of hierarchy almost, like, and if you, you know, the Spanish is like seen as the mother,
the mother.
And if you can trace that you are Spanish descent, it's like, you know, no one wants to trace that they are indigenous or African descent. And it's just like, you know, that's, there is that sense of Latin America, and the whiter you are, you know, the more you are closer to the mother, you know, Spain.
Yeah, and just like how it's problematic, how problematic and how that can just erase history that is so important. And when you think about, you know, I don't know if you've heard this term, but like aclarizar la raza, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I heard from my grandmother growing up, like, you know, you want to marry someone who is fair skinned, or, you know, you need to better, essentially, like, you need to better the race. And it's like, that's problematic.
It is. And it does happen. And in our culture and in the Latino world, there has been for centuries, that whole idea of like, you need to be with someone who is white, and you continue that. And, you know, even whitening your skin. I mean, that's always been, pretty prevalent in the Latino culture. And, the whiter your skin are, you know, the more privileged and the better it is. That's so funny. I love merengue, by the way. There is a song by this merengue artist called Giselle. And she sings Giselle. And she sings a song called El Negro, the Black. And in the song, she talks about how her mother wanted her to marry white skin guy. And she brought home a dark-skinned guy, and that the mother went crazy, you know, because she brought a dark-skinned guy. So she calls him a negro, the black guy, because he was dark-skinned. But yeah, there is, and even in, you hear it in music, and it's interesting, but there is definitely that, you know, that sense of injustice almost as well in our culture.
Right. And I think it's also like, right, it's one thing to celebrate the culture, celebrate the contributions that Indigenous and African people have made to various parts of Latin America. But it's also another thing for the people in those places to have rights, right? Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes we celebrate certain aspects, but when you look at, I just think of like people in Ecuador, even, you know, like the Afro-Ecuadorian population there, the Indigenous population there, and I think Indigenous populations all around the world, right, are fighting for their rights and don't necessarily have the same rights that others in society do have, who maybe are more like mixed with Indigenous and Wai'i, who are more like mestizo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's, you know, a lot of people don't know that there's still a pretty large Indigenous population in Latin America, especially in certain countries like, you know, Bolivia. Mm-hmm. Bolivia has one of the highest Indigenous populations that are still, you know, still there. And mm-hmm. Paraguay, you know, there's a lot of that. There's also in Ecuador too. And it's very similar, right? When we think about Native Americans, right? That their rights and it's like that. It says, you know, the culture is not really allowing them to have their rights as natives, as right to the land, and to mm-hmm. be able to have their rights, practice their culture. And it's, you know, it's just that dominant culture trying to, you know, erase anything that isn't, you know, their culture, the dominant culture, which was created by Spain.
And I would say, like, you know, the personal effects that has on one, because I think, like, subtly or not, like, you kind of pick up on this, like, whether it's from other people and family or friends, like, there's kind of, you look down upon, like, at least growing up, I felt like there was this sort of, like, sense of, you know, Indigenous is inferior, right? And so, you know, even comments like things like my grandma would say, it's like, okay, but, you know, she herself looked, you know, very much a mix of Indigenous and European, right? And I remember, like, for me, even growing up, like, sometimes I didn't like to, even though my hair was all black, I didn't like that. I was like, oh, I want a little bit of color in it, because to me, I felt like that looked more Indigenous. And why did I not like that about myself? Like, you know, even like this kind of, I think it was really like a form of self-hate that I was having on myself, like not kind of wanting my hair to be like that, wanting to have more curly hair, not super straight. And, you know, you kind of, I think I learned that in sort of unconscious ways.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, I think that's so even interesting because, and I like how you called it almost in an unconscious way, that you were doing certain things in an unconscious way, because everything around us was telling us that this is how we have to look. This is what is, and looks,
beautiful,
sexy, whatever. And, mm-hmm. We assimilate to that. And sometimes we do it subconsciously. Like, we don't even know that we're doing it. And we start slowly to, you know, deviate from our roots, our culture. And it definitely takes time to recognize. And I think that I certainly don't claim to be, you know, that I've not assimilated to American culture. Of course I have. But I definitely try to make it a point or make the effort to continue to learn more about my culture and to always embrace and add some of those elements to my life, because I think it's so important. You know, when you open the door to a different culture or finding more about your background, or it just it opens your world even more. It's just you have a much more different outlook of what is life, and you can connect with different people. It's the same kind of concept. When I feel like with languages, I feel like when you know more than one language, you connect with more people in a much more deeper level, because mm-hmm. you can do that. And I think it's the same thing when you embrace your, you know, your inner culture, your background, you know, it just yeah. allows you to connect even further with more people, and you have a much broader sense of the world and life.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree. And I really truly started doing that more, or like embracing my Ecuadorianness, until maybe like college, you know, and even like post-college, in terms of like making sure that I know how to cook certain foods that I grew up eating. Like, I want to make sure I know how to make ceviche and chow la fang and, you know, other things that, you know, my mom knows how to make, or, you know, I could go to my grandma's house and she'll make it for me. But it's so sad, you know, you have people, you don't have every, we don't last forever, right? And I think you can become so dependent on, maybe, or at least I have, right? Or like if I go and I ask my abuelita, can you make this for me? She'll make it. But what about when she's not here anymore? Like, how will I make sure that I can prepare that for myself and prepare for my kids, and that they have that part of them, right? And so I think that it's definitely been a journey to embracing that part of me and celebrating that part of me.
Yeah, I think it's so important. I'm glad to hear that that's something that you're doing for yourself. It just really does. It helps with your own inner almost soul. It just you just find more of yourself, and it just helps you be able to enrich yourself and who you are. And I think so. That's beautiful. That's awesome. Good for you.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So thinking about you know, your experience, you know, I kind of wanted to go back a little bit to, I don't know if you wanted to talk more about, you know, your experience with being, you know, a child of your parents who are immigrants.
So I feel like in terms of navigating, I guess since my mom came when she was 6 years old, she was more in terms of like getting papers and things like that, it was, I think, a little bit easier when she came. But my dad, it was a little bit more difficult. And I will say, I think also because my mom came and she was six, she was able to learn English, and so she's bilingual. But my dad wasn't able to learn English as well. Like, he had little words and phrases he knows. But I think it's almost like you are sort of navigating this new system as, right, like school and doctors. You know, I tell you, my dad got sick when I was very young, and you know, it's like you're still figuring out things, and then you have to figure out things and also explain it to your parent and explain it in the language that they're gonna in the language that they're gonna understand, right? So it was like a lot of I think sometimes when I think back to, and even now, I mean, there's still things that I'll do for my dad. But it's almost like navigating the system for you and also for another person. It's like you're, you know, helping taking care of someone. It's this added responsibility that you have in terms of making sure that, your parent has the information that they need, that they understand what doctors are saying, they understand what teachers are saying, insurance people are saying. It's like, I'm still trying to figure out what insurance is saying. Now I got to figure it out and explain it to you, and also figure out all the words in Spanish, right?
Yeah.
So it's definitely like a lot of responsibility. I think when you, when your parents are immigrants, right, you're navigating the system and help you explaining it to them, right? Making kind of, I think sometimes maybe parents, I will say, maybe are sometimes embarrassed to ask, or, you know, feel more comfortable asking you. But I definitely, not only me, but my sister as well, had to be very sort of hands-on with my dad.
Yeah, I can relate to that, because even with today with my mother, I still, you know, she doesn't know English that well. She can kind of, you know, have a little bit of a conversation, but it's not to that extent. But I've, even to this day, I'm always explaining or translating something for her. And it's always been that way. I think a lot of kids go through that when they're a kid and they're, you know, their parents don't know the language, or, and you as a kid, and not only are you learning it, just as you were saying, you're learning this whole new world, but now you also have to kind of teach it to your parents, almost like you're helping them navigating through it. And it does, you know, it's a lot. It's on a kid, but it's definitely something that we do go through. I think all, you know, anyone who is, you know, an immigrant, or, you know,
from a child of immigrants,
yeah, or yeah, just comes from a different country, and mm-hmm, it happens.
And I think it gives you, I don't know, sort of build your character, where, you know, it's like as a child, as an adolescent, you're teenager, you know, you have experience sort of navigating systems, and I think there are definitely some skills that you build in that regard, when maybe some kids may have their families, you know, kind of their parents will take care of those things, and you don't have an idea of like, how do I, you know, talk to a customer service representative and, you know, ask my question or get my money back or whatever it may be. I think, yeah, you definitely learn at a young age, in some ways, how to advocate for what it is that you need.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it's definitely a skill that you gain and you learn, and at an early age, and you bring into your life. It's definitely a skill that's so transferable into when you become an adult and you go into work or whatever field that you want to work in. And you and I, we work with students. So I think that's a field that we definitely use some of those skills that we learned as kids. You know, we almost had to be adults as kids. And that's like the whole concept of street smart versus book smart, right? And it's all these skills that we, you know, had to learn because we grew up in underprivileged homes, and, you know, our life and socioeconomic status. And we bring those skills to our professional world, and they're just as valuable as, you know, as an education or a skill that you gained through college. They're just as valuable.
Absolutely.
Those are skills that I think would be very interesting to include, like, you know, in an interview or something like that, right?
On your resume.
Yeah, I mean, they're just so, I think they're just very important, and they definitely do add to the character of the person.
Absolutely. I think too, though, it's like, you know, you learn these skills. I think of like my own sort of personal experience, right? It's like you learn how to navigate these systems, but still sometimes like a part of me felt like, you know, it's not okay for me to ask for help. Like if I ask for help, like I'm an imposter, right? Like this idea of imposter syndrome, and, you know, like it's like you experience that, right? Your parents may be asking you for help, but then it's almost like, oh, I need to be able to do this on my own. And like for you to ask for help, I don't know if it's something that we learn in our households, or like, is it in school, you just want to, you know, just sort of feel like I'm smart, I know what I'm talking about, you know, where does that kind of come from?
I don't know per se, but I personally think, you know, I'm very fascinated with the whole concept of imposter syndrome, and I've done my own research on that, and I've done presentations on that. I personally think that it also has to do with, you know, our upbringing. We grew up in, you know, we live in a world where we have a lot of roadblocks against us. And so we always have to feel like we know what we're doing. We can, you know, we don't need to ask for help, because if I ask for help, then that's another, you know, a negative thing on top of me, on top of the fact that I'm, you know, a minority, on top of the fact that I'm, you know, a female or whatever, right? And so we don't want that. I feel like that's what we learn, and we create that almost like that thick skin, because that's almost like our survival, right? And we don't want to feel like we need to ask for help, because we've been, you know, subjected to all these, you know, oppression and all these roadblocks against us. And, you know, we're trying to survive, as you stated earlier, you know, and we don't want to have to feel like vulnerable or like, you know, I don't know. I personally think that's where it also comes from.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess like learned, I think it is something you feel, or I have felt at least, when I'm sort of taken out of my comfort zone and I'm like, as a professional in the workspace, like, oh, I don't want anyone to think like, here's Claudia, like she's not able to do what she can. Here she goes asking for help. But I think it's been really important to learn, like, actually it's okay to ask for help, and you can't do everything by yourself. And unlearning that, I think, it has been difficult, but I'm glad that I think I'm coming to a place where I'm like, I need to be able to ask for this.
Yeah, I think we all need to ask for help when we need it, and we need to be vulnerable. We need to, you know, open ourselves to others, and it's okay, you know. And being understanding of each other, and I think that's the best way that we can grow to love one another and to build bonds, build relationships, and get to know each other. On that note, I know that, you know, we're reaching our time, and I would love to continue having more conversation with you. You know, I kind of wanted to end on kind of thinking about what are you see are your next steps, or your journey in terms of, I know we talked a little bit about finding ourselves, and you know, what is that looking like for you, and what are your next steps?
Yeah, I would say just knowing that it's never too late to begin that journey or get on that journey. I know for me, I've been trying to learn more Spanish vocabulary. I feel like, you know, I can speak Spanish, I can communicate it in it, but there are definitely words that I don't know. And, you know, so how do I continue to learn and build the language, because I think that also helps me it helps me connect with like my family who is in Ecuador and have conversations and feel connected and bond. And I think that that's definitely something that I have been doing and want to continue doing. I think continuing to learn how to make certain foods, and just embracing that I am Ecuadorian, I am American, right? I am not one or the other, but both. And I am Latina who grew up in the Bronx and had a very different experience growing up, where I learned a lot about Puerto Rican culture, Dominican culture, Black culture in the Bronx. And that's a beautiful thing, right? And kind of accepting that and just, I think, yeah, making sure that, I guess one day when I have my own kids, that I'll be able to pass on making sure that they're connected to their roots as, you know, as third generation Ecuadorians. So Ecuadorian Americans.
I love that. I think that's fantastic. And I know, you know, you're going to get there, and I look forward to exploring more of that with you. And I want to learn more about Ecuadorian culture. I want to learn so much more about all different Latin American culture. And, you know, I definitely continued my journey and my Puerto Ricanness. But thank you so much. No, but I really appreciate, you know, you taking the time to do this podcast with me. And I had a great conversation, and I would love to have you back, and we'll do some more conversation about, you know, our identity and the Latino culture.
Absolutely. Thank you. I appreciate you. This is fun.
Thank you. And we'll see each other again soon. Hasta luego.
Yes, muy pronto.
Adios.